right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. How's it going? Are you guys all right? I'm not home. That's why it sounds like this. I got out. I had to get out. It was scary getting out, but I got out. I definitely got out. I had, I'm recording right now in a casita behind a house outside of Taos Village in New Mexico, where I grew up, not in Taos. I grew up in New Mexico. I felt I needed to do something. Monkey was gone. He was sort of keeping me tethered to the house so I could care for him. Lynn obviously is gone. And also, I wanted to point out that today, I might as well do this now, so because I think I need to do it. Today, it would have been Lynn Shelton's 55th birthday. Happy birthday, Lynn. You are missed dearly, desperately, sadly, in all ways, missed. And it's just a fucking, it's ridiculous. What a goddamn ripoff to everybody alive that that woman is not here. Really, so much more life could have been had with or without me. But in bringing up her birthday, I do want to say that there is something that has been set up in her honor by her father and her her husband, her ex-husband. It's a fund at the school where their son went, where Milo went. It's a school for people who have hearing impairment. You can go donate. It would be a nice thing to do if you go to northwestschool.com/donate. You'll see right there at the top the Shelton Seal Family Fund, and it was set up in honor of Lynn and her son Milo and the school that helped them so much. Northwestschool.com/donate. The Shelton Seal Family Fund is something you can do that's proactive and very specific and helps very specific people in a very big way. You're very missed, Lynn. Also, a little more Lynn news. If you go, we did a big tribute to Lynn and her television work for American Cinematheque last night, or the night before last, live. It was a panel. It was me and John Hamm and Reese Witherspoon, Michaela Watkins, Eddie Wang, Kerry Washington. It was great. It was great. You can go to American Cinematheque. That's cinema, T-H-E-Q-U-E, AmericanCinematheque.com, and go to their virtual programming. So it's, you know, / virtual dash programming. And they got a Herzog thing tonight, it looks like, or last night. But there it is, Lynn Shelton tribute virtual Q&A. It's also on YouTube, but that'll get you to the YouTube, I believe. And it looks like they got a lot of cool stuff on there. Free plug, a free plug for American Cinematheque. They deserve it. They got a couple of outlets that aren't operating, a couple theaters. So that being said, oh, by the way, did I mention Billy Crudup is here on the show? Billy Crudup is on the show today, and this is the first time I've ever pronounced it Crudup instead of Crudup, which is wrong. So it's Crudup, and he's here. I talked to him back in the house on the computer, and it was pretty great. It was a pretty great conversation. So look, I couldn't leave my house because Monkey was ill, and I kind of made a promise to myself that when Monkey passed, or when I passed him, when I helped him out into the final frontier, the big leap, that I would try to get away, because I've been home, like many of you, for months on end, however long it's been, since March, mid-March, the end of March, pretty much home, except for a drive to Malibu with Lynn one day, but home, eating at home, cooking at home. Granted, some takeout had been happening, people were sending me food, but everything was being done in the home, in the house. Where Monkey was sick, where Lynn was sick, where, you know, I don't have, you know, my house is not haunted with grief, but I am haunted with grief. And I didn't know if it was possible. Was it possible? Is it possible to go out and be in the world? Here's what I did. I got it in my head. I needed to go somewhere. I couldn't fly anywhere really and feel okay. Because, you know me, I'm getting fucking COVID tests every 2 weeks or so just because, you know, I'm being safe, but I'm a little nuts, a little paranoid. but I don't know that I'm getting less so, but I decided I should come home. I should go to New Mexico. That would ground me. That would, you know, ground my heart. That would ground my mind. I would get up into northern New Mexico. Maybe I could go to Taos specifically and just get up into the hills, into the mountains, into that air, into that sky, into the big frequency that I talked about. I need to tap into the big frequency. So what I did was I joined Airbnb, which I'd not been on. I never went to Airbnb ever. I'd always go to hotels. I don't know. I was Airbnb adverse for years. But for some reason, I'm just like, fuck it. I'm going to join. And I made the reservation. And the woman who owns the house got back to me and said, I don't know why they let you do this. I don't usually accept reservations from people who have not been on the platform before, for newbies, I guess I would be. You didn't put any bio info. There's no picture. I don't know anything about you. So I'm not sure I'm comfortable with this reservation. I'm like, holy fuck, what did I do? So I wrote her, I messaged her back. I said, look, I'm 56 years old. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I've just gone through some, you know, tragic loss in my life. I'm in the entertainment business. I'm a comic, writer, podcast host, producer guy. I'm okay. I grew up in New Mexico. I was looking forward to coming home and maybe, you know, regrouping a bit. And so I kind of rambled on a little bit and sent that off to her. And, you know, a couple hours later, she writes back, well, that was a little too much information. I really just needed a bio, like you'd put on a social networking platform or a social media platform, whatever. I'm like, oh, okay, well, or I'll do that. But can I come? So she said, yeah, and I'm here. And it's lovely. It's great. But I had no idea just how terrified I'd be to leave the house, to get on the road, what to bring, plenty of hand sanitizers, all my different kinds of masks, hats, my plexiglass face protectors. I just had no idea what it would be like to drive out of my 5-mile radius. You know, I made a reservation at the Marriott Courtyard in Flagstaff, and I'm like, what's it gonna fucking be like there in Arizona? Is it gonna be crazy? Are people gonna be like not giving a shit? Is it just gonna be, you know, just are there? Am I just gonna be on the highway with, you know, COVID pilgrims from all over the place out spreading the virus far and wide? What's happening? I was terrified to leave. And I knew other people were doing it. I knew that I had friends that were driving cross country, and I was like, how are they doing it? And then I realized, like, dude, just do what you do here when you go to the supermarket. Just do what you do here. You know, I told you, I think secretly between us, that I have these two, you know, legit N95 masks that I covet. They were given to me by my friend Kit, and I covet them. I only use them when I go into supermarkets and stuff. They're not the casual, you know, hiking up the hill, walking outside, checking into a hotel. But if I'm going to spend some time in a place, I'll go full PPE and I'll put on a N95 and a face screen. So I'm driving, I'm fueled up, I'm scared to stop at fucking gas stations. It's crazy. And then, like, I don't know what it was, but just being in the hotel room, I spent a lot of my life in hotel rooms, and it just felt so alien. 5 months. I hadn't been in a hotel room, hadn't eaten anywhere but my house. I drove, I ordered takeout at this, I think it was called Red Curry Thai or Red Pepper Thai or whatever. It was on the list of the 7 restaurants you can eat at in Flagstaff. But all they're just doing takeout. Everyone's in a mask. I ordered this vegan. It's all vegan. Vegan curries and some fried tofu. And I brought it all back to the room. And I don't know whether it was fear or just the excitement. I don't know what was going on. But it was like the best food I'd ever eaten in my entire fucking life. It was like the food of freedom or something. I don't know. Maybe it was the best Thai food ever. I probably not. But there was just something about not eating at home. Being out, everything was all electrified. It was great. It was great food. And I didn't know if that could continue. But next morning I got up, got out, masked up, hit the road again, made it to Albuquerque. Now here's where it gets sad, because I'm going to my hometown. I'm staying at Los Poblanos for the night. They give me a beautiful suite, but there's fires in northern New Mexico. So there's this orange apocalyptic haze all over fucking New Mexico too, just like California. And I'm like, holy shit, you really can't get away. It really is over. What the fuck is happening? What is happening? It is happening. The plague is going, the fires are going, and I can't even get away from it in my hometown. I'm down the street from my house. I can't get away from it. It was so sad. I head up to see my dad. Didn't want to, did it anyway. Spent 45 minutes in and out. Touched base, sat, told him I loved him, talked to his wife, talked to him. They probably gave me COVID, left. That was it. That was enough. And then the next day I drove to Santa Fe. Right when I got in, went to Tia Sofia's, got some enchiladas, green chili, chicken enchiladas with green chili for me and my buddy Devin, took him up to his house, and I took a couple of bites, and you know, I hadn't seen Devin in a long time, and he's a dear friend, and we go way back, and love the guy. But I don't know, you know, he just was sort of a y'all right, and I just taken a bite of my green chili enchilada, and the tears just consumed me, not because of the food, just because of everything. And I hadn't cried like that, you know, since the first week with my brother after Lynn passed away. And I kind of stifled it, but it happened for a minute. But it was like, it was so dramatic and so guttural and so out of nowhere that I almost lost a bite of my green chili enchilada, which I did not want to do. But it was heavy, man, you know. But he was a good guy to be there for that. But we, you know, we talked and we hung out a bit and I ate. And then I came up here. And I checked into this place, and it's so sweet. It's this beautiful little place up in the foothills of Taos, not on the ski area side, but on the other side. You know, it was great. I'm just trying to clear my head. And I think Lynn, you know, and I don't believe this stuff, but why not? I was taking all kinds of pictures. I was so excited to be up and out and alone on the, usually I'm terrified of being eaten by animals or falling into a ditch and having to, you know, cut my own arm off with a shoe, you know, I didn't have any fear these last couple of days. And I just went up and I just did it. And I thought about her, I thought about me, I thought about the future. I thought about, you know, what do I need to do for myself? What do I need to do for other people? What I need to do for my country? A lot going on, but just the sadness, the grief was there, but it was like part of the frequency. It's part of the big continuity. It's part of the momentum of humanity. The grief. It's weird though, what I do to not feel feelings. You know, if I, whether it's listen to music or just sit around and think about all the horrible shit I've done in my life. There's that seems to be my body, my brain's way of dealing with having immediate feelings in my brain. It's like, you can have those and be sad, or you can just, you know, maybe beat the shit out of yourself for things you did before. How would that be for a while? That could go on, you know, ad infinitum, pal. Yeah, you know, you've changed, you're who you are, but like, let's go over the books. I'm like, can't I just feel the grief? All right, but you know, let me know when you want to crack these bad boys. I'm like, look, man, I've made my amends. come on, let me up for air. But I did the breathing and I saw the views and I took the pictures and it's been just great. It really has. I'm reading a book on meditation. Well, I read the first few pages. I brought a guitar. I haven't played it yet. But, you know, no pressure. I'm all right. I stopped in Arroyo Seco. Is that it? I think it's a little town just shy of the ski area. I bought some pots, bought some ceramics for my house, even though I might have to be moving in a hurry. Who knows, right? It was fucked up, though. I was in one of the pottery stores, and the guy said, you know, there's a whole family of Nazis just came in here in full uniform. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? He's like, well, they were wearing some kind of uniform. I think it was a white supremacist uniform. And I'm like, are you serious? They just came in like, you know, like nothing was happening? Yeah. And I was like thinking, get the fuck out of my store, white supremacists. I'm like, a family. He's like, yeah, that's fucking nuts. He's like, they might still be out there. Look around. I'm looking. There's nobody in this town. There's 12 people, some tourists eating tacos across the street, people wandering around with masks. It's a little tourist town. It's like 5-10 stores and a taco place, and it's up in the mountains. I'm like, what are the fucking white supremacists doing fully uniformed? A family. They weren't still there. And for some reason, I had to ask. I'm like, well, when they were in here, did they wear their masks? He's like, yeah, they all wore their masks and they were actually very nice. I'm like, well, that's how it's going to happen. That's what it's going to be like. You're just going to know. You're not going to say anything. You're going to be scared and they're going to be very nice and follow the rules. And, you know, we have to follow their rules. Jesus Christ. And by the way, the air is actually a little clearer here and it rains up here in Taos every day. It kind of cleans the palate of the big frequency. I'm okay. Are you guys okay? So, Billy Crudup, not Crudup, of course you know him from Almost Famous. It's our big reunion. I haven't spent any time with Russell since my equipment fucking shocked him back in the day. So he's, you know him from that movie, Almost Famous, Watchmen, his many shows on Broadway, The Morning Show, which he's nominated for an Outstanding Supporting Actor Emmy this year. That's happening. That's why he's on the show. Also, I might want to tell you that he's a little punchy. He'd been up all night, and I think he seemed pretty caffeinated. And we got to talking, man. We got to some serious talking. So, again, he's nominated for playing Corey Ellison on The Morning Show in the category of Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Drama Series. You can watch all of season one of The Morning Show on Apple TV Plus. And this is me and Billy Crudup coming up.
Nice to see you, man. Been a while.
It's been a while. Yeah. It has been a while. That is true. When did we make that movie, Billy?
Geez, hard to remember right now. Some people seem to suggest it was 20 years.
Oh, that's right. There was a big anniversary that I wasn't invited to. 20 years.
You were invited. You just weren't available, man. You've got this thing going and it keeps you busy 24/7.
That is not true. I could have come and recaptured my amazing 2 minutes on screen.
I have this memory. I don't know if it's invented or not, but of watching you and Noah do that fight from inside the bus and it being one of the more entertaining parts of that experience.
He made us do it like 10 times.
I know. And I remember Noah's voice getting shot too. And it was done for like a week and a half.
Wow. Oh my God. There was several versions of it where Noah comes out. Every time, I think he was on the bus telling Noah to do shit to fuck me up. So like one time he came out and broke a guitar. Another time he showed his ass.
I remember the showed his ass part. I had forgotten about that. Oh, what a fantastic memory. That's really nice.
That was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. That was a long time ago. And everybody was so deep in it. I remember that. I mean, I come on for one day and you guys were acting like a real band.
Yeah, it was a totally immersive experience, I'll tell you that. From the second we all said yes, Cameron had us in band camp and was the mind meld was like instituted immediately where he wanted to make sure that all of us well, for me in particular, because I was not a band guy, the other three were. That we were all part of the same thing, and I didn't fuck it up.
They'd all the other guys had been in bands.
Yeah,
Jason too.
Yeah, Mark.
I know Mark.
Yeah, the Red House Painters, and our drummer John was the session drummer for him occasionally, and then Jason Lee. You know, I don't know if he ever had a formal band, but he played the guitar. You know, he could sing.
Yeah, he was actually the weirdest to me.
Jason
out of all of them. Yeah.
And the character or the person?
I couldn't tell. You know, I projected a lot into it. You know, I felt distinctly like he was shutting me out. And I thought, well, maybe I'm one of those negative people that Scientologists are afraid of. So I thought that might be it.
I liked him very much. We got along perfectly well. Like, and the antagonistic relationship that developed was really enjoyable to play.
But it wasn't real.
No, oh no, not at all. I can't do anything for real. It's all fake, man. This is like
really?
I don't know how to play guitar. I mean, this as you can see, this is real.
You can do this, yeah.
The whole acting part of it, you know, some people they get you use the word immersive. For me, that's all about the content and the story. You get immersed in the storytelling of it, not actually personally immersed in the experience of it. Sometimes there are, you know, residual effects because you trick your body long enough that it fires the chemicals it's supposed to fire. And then you feel emotionally hungover the next day. It's a real effect of, you know, like going through some of the traumatic parts of playing a character, or some of the connections, you know.
Well, that's interesting. So you don't really now like to go back to Jason. Like, I think that his reaction to me was appropriate for the character. I thought everybody handled me for my little part there.
Which is, you're killing us. Get the fuck out of our way.
Well, that and just, you know, I was a promoter and, yeah, the band is not going to be the pal of the promoter. But, you know, but me, Mark Maron, was just this insecure idiot who was there for a day's work and wandering around saying hi to people. And, you know, the saddest part for me was that, you know, I had a shoot. Like, you know, I felt like part of the crew there for a while, part of the team. You know, Cameron even ate with me and my wife at the time. And then, like, when I had to chase the van, the bus and the cart, everybody left. It was just me and a secondary crew, B team, just me riding up and down that ramp by myself in the middle of the fucking night. And I'm like, this is show business? What happened to everybody?
No, we were there in spirit, man. We were there, you know.
I know how it works now.
That's right. I get it. I'm off camera. Get me the fuck out of here. I'm back to my hotel. Of course.
Why would anyone stay? I just had to suck up that bus
exhaust
overnight.
That is a pet peeve of mine. And sometimes producers, there's a bait and switch where they'll tell you you're not needed. And then the next day you show up and the actor's like, so you don't do off camera? And what are you fucking talking about? But if this would have been a scenario where I would have said, we're on the bus.
Yeah.
The windows are closed.
Yeah.
I mean, if Mark needs me on the bus, I'll stay up. Sure. Just no problem.
That's how I connect, man. I need to know that all that emotion is still
feeling
on the bus.
It's riding away. Yeah. You'll be able to sense my seething emotions from inside the bus.
But that's interesting that, well, I mean, I know that's a thing. I will always do off camera too. I mean, I guess sometimes, you know, not that I do a lot of acting, but I do more now, but it seems like the right thing to do unless, you know, it's really nothing.
It almost always seems like the right thing to do, not the least of which, because I feel like the whole bait and switch of doing a movie or a play or TV show, whatever, is, you know, convincing the audience that everything is happening for the first time when it's highly choreographed and you've collaborated on the narrative together and you're just simply executing it as craftspeople. And to that way of thinking, I want to be in on it. So I want to influence your performance. I want you to influence my performance. So if you say you don't need me for off camera, I'm like out of the fuck. I don't know what I'm doing there.
Right. Well, I mean, I think I was talking to Rob Reiner or James Brooks. I don't know who, about Jack Nicholson on the set of A Few Good Men, you know, in the scene where he's in the witness box.
Right.
And he goes off.
Right.
Yeah, even when he was off camera, he did it all the way.
Right.
All the way.
Yeah.
I think it was Reiner, because I think Reiner directed it. So why do you do it? Why do you keep doing it all the way? He goes, because I love to act, man.
I couldn't agree more. It's such a privilege. And when you're firing, when you're like, I mean, that scene obviously became iconic for him too. Right. So that must have been incredibly fun to play. But when you're firing with people, there's no greater joy. Most actors slog to get any work at all, you know, much less something they enjoy, much less something that they feel is important to be a part of. You know, like all of those things are, there's so many layers to this profession that, you know, I'm sure the people that you speak to are all occupying a certain echelon that, like, those worries are long gone. But for me, you know, I went to acting school with, 18, 20 people who were really good young actors. And so many of them now don't work at all. And so many of the ones that do work in things that are unsatisfying. There are, a handful that get good opportunities and are given the opportunity to exploit them and move on and have great, but the abundance of good fortune that I've had is absolutely apparent to me at every stage.
And you have gratitude.
Endless stores of gratitude. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how people do it. I don't know how you guys do it, because I don't know how you go on doing it without getting a break or without getting opportunities, because you're showing up, you're auditioning to do somebody else's bidding, and you're hoping that bidding is good, at least well written to some degree, and if it isn't, you got to suck that up and make the best of it, and sometimes it's well, the one thing I noticed about acting when I started to do it more for the TV show, I'm like, with TV acting, you know, you do a thing and it's like 2 seconds. You get it, you know, you're on camera. It's like, hey, wait. All right, cut. Let's turn the cameras around. And it's like, what the fuck does that? That's a day?
Yeah.
And there was actually a moment where I was like, this is fucking ridiculous. I'm just sitting around watching The Sopranos on my phone for 4 hours, but I've grown to be a little more grateful. But none, but I guess what I'm leading towards is that it sounds to me that your process is not all immersive to the point where you're going to convince yourself that you've become a character. And I imagine that doing theater kind of knocks the kind of pragmatic working element, the sort of like, I'm a working actor guy. Like, I think theater really is what must define what feels good about acting.
Well, I have had that experience. It's true. And it was the philosophy was instilled in me before that. And the reason for that gratitude is in no small part because of the abundance of opportunities I had early in my career. I actually felt bad about it. I felt bad about telling some of my peers about like the great jobs that I was getting. And like, you know, I was 6 months out of school and I was playing one of the leads in a Tom Stoppard play on Broadway, directed by Trevor Nunn at Lincoln Center. And like, I was originating the American part of it. Nobody gets to fucking do that. I wanted to hide my head in the sand. It was, I mean, not to mention the fact that I was shitting myself in everybody's company trying to accomplish that. But we were taught about, and the reason I went to graduate school originally, you know, I thought I might teach because I didn't know anybody who was a professional actor.
The great thing about actors is that, like, you can tell all your friends about this amazing opportunity, and because they're actors, you know they're not going to be bitter or resentful of you, which is one of the great things about that community. Yeah.
Well, I have to say, I do have some anomalous experiences because me and my friends are incredibly supportive of each other, and I think this goes back to your point of theater, but I also think it has to do with New York. So yeah. Many of the actors that I came up with. Sam Rockwell, Josh Hamilton, Ethan Hawke, and then Joel Delafuente, John Conley, Carl Kensler, all these guys from school, we all are still in touch and supportive of each other. We actually went through that version, each of us at different times with one another, where, you know, we would just talk about how shitty it was that some people had, you know, these opportunities and how thrilled they were that others of us were having other opportunities. And they, like, really would... It is different in Los Angeles.
Right. Well, I think it also sounds like that's a handful of guys, and it seems like the bitter, nasty ones probably you just weren't friends with because, you know, there's got to be a few.
We could only put up with them for so long, and we pulled the herd over the years, possibly.
Well, it's just like it just filtered out that way, you know?
Well, it is a pretty broad grouping, though, when I think of it now. Like, how many... There's got to be a good 20 people that I'm still in touch with and really supportive of, you know.
Oh, that's great. No, yeah. I mean, maybe I'm just thinking of comics, or maybe I'm just thinking about me.
But of course you're thinking about actors. And every time somebody gets a part that I really wanted, turning down the volume on the envy, you know, is really difficult. And
what was the one time that you can remember where that was really like, was it something?
What do you mean, like today? I mean, this shit happens all the time, Mark. Like, to your point before about the never ending series of potential like crevasses you're going to fall into, it starts with, can you get the audition? If you get the audition, are you going to nail it in the audition? Are you then going to nail the callback? Are you going to do okay in the meeting with the director? All of those like are replete with things.
But
that you
dude,
can fuck
you're
up.
Like, you're fucking.
Oh no, I still audition. I still audition.
Okay. But I mean, you do walk in. They're not like, who's this guy?
Some of them are like, you're still acting. That's great. And I'm like, what? You don't care for the theater? Go fuck yourself. But then after you get the part, then there's the question of executing the part, right? Because I've been fired from a job too. Once you execute the part, then it's a question of whether or not you're in the film. Then if you're in the film, it's a question of whether or not the critics like it. Then if the critics like it, it's a question of whether anybody goes and sees it. I mean, every one of those things can play with your sense of self-consciousness.
Yeah, right. But a lot of them are out of your control, I imagine.
They are out of your control. But getting to that point where you recognize that is really hard because you want to have, unless you're somebody who can write, I can't. I'm a completely interpretive artist. I need somebody to give me material. They need to tell me what the story is going to be. They need to give me some perspective on how I can help them tell the story before I'll have any kind of creative agency or insight. Like for, so for people like me who are waiting for people that they respect to come to them, it can sometimes be a long, frustrating wait. So
sure.
Saying that it's out of your control is one thing, but being able to internalize it in a way that you're not immobilized.
It's immobilized, heartbroken.
Yeah, that's it. That's where the community of Confederates comes in handy.
Sure.
Is, you know, we all lean on each other at different times.
Well, yeah. And then after a certain point, that group of actors, you've all been cut out of things. You've all, you know, done great things that were never seen. You know, you've all made mistakes and things that you took and are out there. So you know, with age comes a certain amount of humility that must aid in the ability to go like, fuck it. That didn't work out.
No question about it. In fact, I think that as we get older and discover that we know and have known less and less, the sense of humor seems to be rising to the top, you know.
No, it has to. It has to, or you just fucking implode.
Yeah, you're dead
but
in the
water. Let's get back to that, the process of like, because I don't talk to, well, you try to talk to actors about, you know, how they do it, how they, you know, what their craft is. Or I used to do it a lot when I was starting to act more so I could get free acting lessons. But, you know, what it comes down to is like, what is the, you know, the most effective way that these individuals, on top of their natural talent to do it, are able to pretend to be somebody else? So, you know, how do you engage that? But it seems like you're kind of practical about it.
Well, there's two different things you were talking about there. I was thinking about before, too. Like, I'm for the collective enterprise to create a cathartic event for people, right? That's what ultimately you're doing. You're having somebody pay $13, the same way when you're doing a comedy show, I'm going to charge you $20, and I hope this 10 minutes gives you a giggle. Or I'm going to charge you $40, and I hope you laugh your ass off. You know, like that's... Yeah. It's the same thing for...
And we're all going to charge you $75 and thank you for subscribing this season. We hope you enjoy the play.
Yeah,
you need the hearing aids.
There's
you
that version the- too. We've kept the theater alive for you, so enjoy your nap. I've been in plenty of those productions. And by the way, giving people good nap. Proud of that because sometimes
sometimes
we need nap. But the
all right, so the cathartic enterprise,
yeah,
that's
so
one
that's a comprehensible journey to me, you know, like I like being in a group of people doing it. There's the other version of it, which is some people are really, really good, and the event is watching the peacock, the event is watching somebody display these skills in a radical way that like takes you out of yourself. You know, that happens in athletics. I'm sure there are people in comedy as well who just have an explosive kind of gift. That
so you're saying that sometimes even, but that doesn't preclude the ensemble element. That you're just, the ensemble is in support of the peacock, and you got to live with that fucking weirdness.
Yeah, exactly. And that's all the time. I mean, and people sometimes who have been a part of the ensemble before become the peacock for a moment. You got to navigate that moment. I mean, all of us have been through it. But for the audience, I was thinking, you know, like sometimes I'll pay to go see a Meryl Streep movie, whatever she's doing. I don't know what the movie is, but
of course
that's somebody who can fucking work. So you want to see the work. And but usually it's about the story, whether or not the story works, whether or not that's what I want to do to curate my evening. And that is the workman part of it that I was taught in school, which is you take your time going over the text, collaborating with the director, the other actor. You become very fastidious about how you understand your role in creating this event. And then you try to do that. You try to technically implement that in a way that makes it seem like it's happening.
Right. When you watch Meryl Streep, though, can you see the work? I can't see the work.
No. it's upsetting, you know, as somebody who has spent a lot of time and money trying to figure it out. It is it's disappointing and humiliating, but it's thrilling to see somebody, you know, in the same way you see Jordan or anybody who has a rare kind of gift.
Yeah.
I don't know how he makes his body move like that, you know, in processing information.
Some people just, it's natural talent.
And she's both too, because she went to school as well and is highly trained in theater and she can sing. It just doesn't end with her, but she can also collaborate, you know, with people in the way that I'm familiar with, but she does it on a different level.
Have you worked with her?
No.
Why not?
Nobody's asked once again.
Have
Mark.
You been in, have you been in movies together where you just didn't have scenes together or no?
I don't think so.
No.
No. I'm not going to take that personally. I just showed my son Defending Your Life. You remember that Albert Brooks movie?
Sure.
I'm a sucker for Albert Brooks and certainly was, you know, like in my family, he was somebody that we all kind of enjoyed collectively. So I was thrilled how much he enjoyed Albert Brooks as well. But watching Meryl Streep's capability in even a comedy that, you know, is kind of a heightened fun comedy it's very hard to do. It's very hard.
Yeah,
to
but
do.
It was like it was amazing. My recollection of seeing her in that movie was like she must be doing him a favor. They must be friends. Why the fuck is she in this movie?
I bet that she loved doing it. I mean, you know, for the first time, she didn't have to be tormented by like the death of a child.
Right. How old's your kid?
He's 16.
16. Wow. That's kind of my buddy's got a 16, a 15-year-old. Sounds can be rough.
Yeah. I don't know how it was for you. But
when I was 15, I grew up in New Mexico, so we could drive by then. But yeah,
when did you start driving?
14 and 9 months. You got your learner's permit.
Right. I started driving early too. I mean, I didn't get my learner's permit until 15, but yeah.
Where'd you grow up?
Well, this was in Dallas.
Right. New Mexico. I guess it's the same. They're like, it's plenty of room. Let the kids drive.
There was something called a hardship. There was a hardship license. And I think it was mostly for families in rural communities who, if somebody was working, they needed to drive the kids to school or something. And, my parents were divorced at that point and my mom was working. And so my brother turned 15 and got his hardship license and was driving us around. And so, you know, I was a year and a half younger than him. And one day he decided to teach me and it was a stick shift Volvo station wagon.
Nice.
And I just remember viscerally learning how to deal with a clutch on a suburban Dallas street.
That was the only thing, like when I was a kid, it was like that you wanted, like any idiot could drive an automatic. So like when I got the opportunity to learn, I learned on a standard and I'm very happy. I haven't driven one in fucking years.
I know. They're great
to
drive though. Yeah.
Yeah.
I there was a pickup truck that my dad had one summer.
With the three on the tree?
Yes. Now that's a fucker to drive. I mean, you feel like you've done something if you've made it through a day on that one.
Right. They're scary and they kind of lurch around.
And a really loose clutch, you know, like you don't know when the gear is kicking in, really. You know, it could be like 3 feet of give.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 So what, your dad was a pickup truck guy?
No, no, he was a businessman. He tried to do a lot of different things and, but you know, most consistently, he was a bookie and a loan shark. And, I think this pickup was probably payment, at a certain point that then my brother and I were given used to, drive. He obviously wasn't a high level bookie based on the pickup truck. He always tried to like find his way back into a normal way of doing business by buying products that were in the marketplace that had failed in the marketplace. He'd buy the copyright and then he would try to remarket them. Like there was these umbrella hats. I don't know if you remember in like the late 70s, early 80s.
I can picture them.
Yeah. And so there was, you know, they came out with the rainbows on them or whatever, and they didn't really work because why would anybody do that? But my dad thought, I know what I'll do. I know Lou Brock, who was a baseball player for St. Louis, I believe. And he was like, I'm going to get Lou Brock to endorse these and we're going to sell the Brock umbrella. And sure enough, we had, you know, I don't know, 2,000 of these things in the basement. So he was always trying to, he was an entrepreneur, but, and he, you know, he wanted his pet rock. That's what he thought.
No, of course. Right. Happen. Right. If I
well,
could just get the pet.
My mom is the one who is working, keeping everything together, working in an advertising agency and taking care of three kids in their teens, boys, three boys. So she's the hero in the story of that.
So when he was a bookie, was he his own man or was he working for someone else?
Yeah, I suspect there was just someone else involved there, Mark, to your question. Because
it doesn't sound like your dad's got the muscle.
Yeah, well, he did work with a man named Mr. O, who was a 6'4" former boxer.
Oh, okay, so that was his guy. He had
who
Mr.
Had a
O
pit bull named Bullet. Yes, and oh, I mean he carried a firearm, you know, and all of it was very charming. Like he was a really charming guy. He made it seem perfectly normal. When there was like, you know, a riot shotgun next to his bed one day, he was like, "Oh no, that's fine. Just don't touch it." You kind of think, "Is it fine? Okay." Man, it's,
yeah, it makes me nervous. Makes me nervous.
I don't know why, but that thing, you know, it's it loaded. You have stuff for it too. All right. Yeah. Okay.
Did you ever go out shooting?
Not with him. No, I don't think I ever did. I was in the Boy Scouts, and I went to a camp, a YMCA camp, right. One summer, two summers. Where, you know, you do riflery and stuff, but that's
the 22s.
About the extent of my shooting. Exactly, 22 rifles. But I guess you did a lot in New Mexico.
Well, I went to a camp as well where we learned how to load shotgun shells and, you know, shoot skeet, and we did some 22 stuff. And then my dad had some guns around. My friend, there was a lot of guns around, you know, and I ended up shooting guns here and there. I never owned one. Recently, I've been thinking maybe I should get one, but then there's always the possibility that you might have a bad day.
Yeah, so, it didn't seem like a good idea to me either.
I decided on a bat. I'm going to get a bat.
I don't feel confident enough in my ability to protect myself with the gun.
Yeah,
you know, when I look at things statistically, back to my rationalization agenda here, it doesn't seem statistically in your best interest to have one around for your own safety.
No, that's for fucking sure. I read this article about, like, not that I'm depressive, but, you know, you have your moments, right? But,
sure.
In England, the suicide rate went down dramatically when they changed the type of natural gas that was available in the ovens to a less toxic type of gas. that the number of people that just didn't follow through because it didn't work out.
Picturing some awful macabre comic moments where some, you know, person in a desperate state, "What the fuck is wrong with this gas?"
Exactly. But then they live through that and the next day they feel okay. That's the point, is that if you don't have the gun in that moment, you're probably going to get a night's sleep and be all right.
It's a smart move to put as many impediments in the way of those kind of
self-destruction.
Yeah.
So wait, how old were you when the folks split up though?
We were living in Long Island and they were divorced when I was six. So that was like 1974. Right. And then they tried to make it work again. And that's when we moved to Dallas because my dad had the business opportunities. But as you could hear from my previous stories, those business opportunities didn't lead to more security and predictability. So my mom did the smart thing and let him move out on his own. And
with his umbrella hats?
Yeah, with his umbrella hats, precisely, which did not fit in his new singles apartment, I can assure you. He was the kind of guy who had storage spaces everywhere. Like, you know, we're just going to, hey, need to run out to Plano for an afternoon. What's going on? Well, got to check out the storage space. I believe I've uncovered a few gems that, and of course, you know, you just go pick out shit and we go to the flea market and he tried to sell it there.
Oh God. So he was like, he was just not even a good hustler really.
Yeah, exactly. He was a marginal hustler.
Anytime there's a flea market involved, that's hit or miss.
Not if that's where you're aiming. If you're aiming there, flea market, you're going to come in 9 times out of 10. You're going to come out happy because, you know, it's not like you're going to make a killing one way or the other. And if you don't sell it, So, right. I mean, it's not like you have a whole lot of stink. But I do have a big affection for flea markets and people on the fringes, I think, for that reason.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if it's part of your childhood, I mean, how are you not going to?
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's moments where I used to love to go to the flea market. But my dad, there's part of my childhood where, you know,
what did he do?
No, my dad, he didn't sell at the flea market, but I used to go to the flea market all the time because I was fascinated with it. All I remember is there was a doctor in town who my father knew and who was Jewish. We're Jewish. This guy was Jewish, and he used to sell Nazi paraphernalia at the flea market. And I could never quite connect it, but I was sort of found it kind of fascinating.
Well, I mean, immediately I jumped to the notion that, like, if he can make a few bucks off these fuckers, that's sure. That's a thorn in the side.
It's back in the old days. It was the old days, and it was exactly. Real stuff. It was like right. The real, like, it wasn't kind of new. It's not like today where they're making the stuff new for the new
right,
generation.
Exactly. Well, and he may not have thought through thoroughly who he was selling to. Like, who
that's
might
true.
Want to collect this kind
yeah,
of stuff?
That's true. That's true. But my dad, we used to, like, there was a period there where he was into showing to dog shows. So there's part of my life that there's dog shows involved. So I have sort of a soft spot for it, but I don't go to them, you know.
Well, Best in Show was enough for me to.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what it's like. So you're moving around. So you, like, where did you end up, like, going to high school? Dallas?
Well, I went to a lot of different schools. And, you know, in Dallas at the time, there was busing. And so I was at a elementary school in one area. And then I went to a middle school. We were bused to a middle school for seventh and eighth grade. Yeah. And then I went to high school for 1 year. At Hillcrest High School. And then we moved down to South Florida.
Oh my God.
As my mom got remarried. And we went.
How was that guy?
And we went to, St. Thomas Aquinas High School, and it was a Catholic school. But I had an excellent time there. I really did. I thought, they're most notable for, their athletics, program. And, like Michael Irvin went there. He was there when I was there, and Brian Piccolo. Remember Brian Song and
sure.
Chris Evert.
They all went there.
They all went there, and I was not. I mean, as you might be able to tell by my size, a stellar athlete. But I
did soccer.
Wrestle.
You could do soccer. Oh, wrestle. Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't fast enough. I loved playing soccer when I was younger, but when I at my freshman year at Hillcrest, I tried out for the team, and I just started to grow. I was always the shortest kid in class.
Yeah.
And me and Richard Winfield, we would compete for shortest kid just about every year. But
yeah,
then,
how's that guy? I wonder what he's up to.
He's great, actually. He's a lawyer in Dallas, and I think he does really well. I think he won. But
he's a little lawyer in Dallas.
I think he's bigger now, just like me, almost good. Average size. But I had just started to grow and became, you know, wildly uncoordinated and was so slow that they called me Flash. And that's when I thought, okay, I'm done with this shit.
Right.
And I wrestled, but the 1 year I was not great at wrestling. I was kind of, you know, I was there for the exercise and I did like the sport. But the 1 year I didn't wrestle, we won state. It gives you some idea of my ability and the ability of the
you didn't drag him down, huh?
I didn't drag him down. I wasn't there to wave him down.
Are your folks still around?
My dad's not. No, he passed away in 2005. He was 63. But my mom is around, and like she's really the genesis of how I got into acting. She loved taking us to the theater and going to Broadway and stuff growing up. So
really, but how long? So wait, just wait. So you're in Florida.
Oh now, yeah. What, no, first we were on Long Island. My dad was selling yarn.
Yarn.
Cause he was from a small town in North Carolina that had a yarn mill. And so he was selling that yarn here in the city.
So he worked out like he worked out an angle with the yarn mill where he grew
this
up.
This was before the angling. So what happened was when they came up to New York, I mean, this, I'm kind of putting this together. I don't know if this is true or not, but he comes up to New York to sell yarn, a legitimate business, you know, like the his dad was the vice president of marketing there. He got, you know, got a job there selling the yarn here in the city. He was working in the garment district. And then he was in the garment district and got introduced to some people that he found more colorful than the fabric he was selling. And, I think he was intoxicated by that life, you know. My mom, meanwhile, was like, "Why are we at a mob funeral? That doesn't seem." Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot going on there. But she loved the arts, loved the theater, and so even after we moved to Dallas and Miami and Fort Lauderdale and stuff, she would still bring us back to New York to see plays. And you know, I saw some phenomenal productions, and she was also like one of my primary support engines when I was younger about performing.
When did you first start doing the performing?
I would say, I don't know if you remember my first grade interpretation of Uncle Sam during the 4th of July festivities.
I've read about it. I read some of the many critical pieces on that.
Yeah, the smallest next big thing, I think it was called. that's when what I discovered was my way, you know, of fitting in, going to these different schools was being the class clown. So I didn't have any problem humiliating myself in front of people, which is one of the crucial things about being an actor. There's not dignity in the act of doing it. It's
Is that a class at NYU?
There's no dignity in acting.
You know, getting over embarrassment by making a fool.
Well, it's funny you say that because that is what people end up doing. You know, there's not a specific class about it, but nearly everybody at some point or another makes themselves as vulnerable as possible. Often it's in the form of like being completely nude. Everybody has to get completely nude at some point in acting school just to bare their truth, you know?
Right.
It's exhausting.
Or the person that cries too much all the time, like no matter what they're doing.
That's me now, but it wasn't me then.
You were the nude guy.
I wasn't yet the nude guy. Actually, I wasn't nude until my first paying job in the city.
That's how it usually works.
I was nude for $212 a week. And
Welcome, kid. Take it out.
I was super excited about it until maybe 2 weeks into it when I'm standing backstage in a pretty cold theater thinking, what the fuck am I doing right now?
Which gig was this?
This was it was a kind of esoteric think piece on Japanese internment camps. I played the token.
So that was worth it, right? That was worth it?
It absolutely was, and I'll tell you why. Okay, this is a great freaking transition. I didn't even see this one coming. But it was at the Vineyard Theater. And the Vineyard Theater on Union Square, fantastic theater. They hired me a couple of years ago to do a solo performance of this guy, David Cale's play. It was a one-man show. And so I played a bunch of different characters. It was an hour and 15 minutes long. But Jen Aniston and one of her producing partners came and saw that. And after they saw that, she was like, I want you to be a part of the morning show. We just have to figure out at what capacity. So me doing that $212 job a week has brought me to, you know, one of my favorite roles that I've had
in the same theater.
I did it in the same theater. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
But going back to your mom, like, so you were always doing stuff on stage throughout junior high.
Yeah,
high
there
school.
Wasn't an acting program at St. Thomas. As you know, they put most of their money into the athletics department.
Yeah.
But I went to UNC Chapel Hill, and
town.
Yeah, I love Chapel Hill, man. That's a great town. Have you worked there before? Shows there? Yeah, it's a really great town. But I started out as like a business major because I suppose that's what you were supposed to do at school. And then,
well, with such an impressive father as a role model to of what's possible.
You know, it was kind of, I haven't thought about this in a while, but his mom passed away the day that I graduated from high school. And he had always vowed to her that, because he didn't finish Chapel Hill. He had like 9 hours left or something, you know, like he had to take 3 or 4 classes, told her he was going to finish. She passed away when I graduated, and he went back to summer school in Dallas so he could graduate and get his degree just before I started there. So like, you know, he was very proud that he was a straight A student. He had a backpack that he gave me that I then used, you know, when I was in school there.
Yeah.
So there was some charm to it, but maybe that's why I got into business is, that was my first major. I thought, well, some of us needs to know how to do it.
Yeah. He got it done.
He did. He graduated.
Yeah. So you thought like, you know, I'm just going to like, you know, he didn't quite master it, but I'm going to be the guy.
Exactly. Let's give this generation a second go. But, you know, my first semester, it was clear that I was not going to succeed well as a business major. So I just started taking as many different kinds of classes as I could. And I took this one class called Oral Interpretation of Prose and Poetry that was taught by Paul Ferguson. And he became like an immediate mentor to me. And I knew that these were my people. Like I didn't know what it was that we were doing with this art form. Nobody was going to really pay to see this. We did a production of James Joyce's short story Clay, I think it was called, it's not a play. So you have to spend half of your time figuring out how to make it a play. And then you use the narration as a part of your like first person speaking. It's weird stuff.
Yeah.
But what it allows you to do is, think creatively about what kind of thing you're, you know, engaging in. It's not just about like, oh, I've been dying to play Annie.
yeah.
By the way, I have been dying to play Annie, and I'm not going to settle for Daddy Warbucks. So, but I made A's, and so I could be, a good student there while taking these performance classes, and I became a communications major because I thought, well, who's going to go into acting? And I can use the communication major as my way into the workplace. And I had taken all the performance classes in there. And then I started going to the drama department, taking classes there. And then the drama teachers there, Susanna Reinhardt, Didi Corvinus, they like convinced me that I could take some of the major classes there. So by the time I had finished, I'd taken every performance class at Chapel that they offered.
And you were doing productions as well?
I was doing productions too. Yeah, I think that... I did You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. I did Burn This. I did Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy, which I would later do. And I played Arturo Uy in that production, I'll have you know. But I would later do it with Al Pacino playing Arturo Uy off Broadway. So that was a nice full circle moment.
So you did theater with Al Pacino?
I did. That cast, can I tell you? Steve Buscemi, Charles Durning, John Goodman, Tony Randall, Paul Giamatti, Linda
That's
Eamon.
Crazy.
Yeah, and I'm forgetting people. Sterling Brown, Johnny Ventimiglia. It was an unbelievable cast. We had an absolute ball doing it. I'm forgetting like 300 people that were in it. But it was directed by this guy, Simon McBurney, who ran this theater company in London that did some of the most incredible productions I've ever seen. They're called Theatre de Complicité or Complicity now or whatever.
Yeah.
But so to get to work with him and to see somebody with that kind of mastery of the craft was pretty, it was killer.
Yeah, because I think Pacino can still do it when he wants to.
Oh, he works his ass off. I'll tell you that straight up. I mean, he works his ass off and he is invested in it, you know, and I can't say that for everybody, but
him play when he did Kevorkian in that HBO movie.
Oh yeah,
like, holy fuck! I mean, because like there was a while there where he was just sort of but like when, but
you gotta
then,
figure
like,
at a certain point, nobody is giving him direction. You know, they're saying that's how you like to do it. Sure,
right, because they're nervous. Why then?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, listen, if you do Dog Day Afternoon and Godfather Part Two in the same year, which I think he did, those two different roles that are so brilliantly executed, you know, fuck it, that's more. You've had more than your share, okay?
Yeah, you can do whatever you want,
whatever you want for the rest. Yeah. But I don't think he has ever lacked in a continued commitment to working.
It's just odd to see that generation, you know, becoming these old men and who kind of can still not do it.
Yeah.
But okay, let's go back to, so you finish at Chapel Hill, then you go to Tisch, and that's where you really lock in. Is that how it works?
Yeah, exactly. And it is a professional actor training program that focuses you on essentially taking the shotgun approach. Like, we're going to teach you as many different skills. So when you enter the workplace, whatever you're offered, whether it's voiceovers, whether it's commercials, whether it's theater, film, television, yeah, whatever, you're going to be moderately prepared to get into it. And right. So it's also in New York City. So casting directors and agents would come and see some of the productions that you were doing. They not just because they're looking for talent, but because some of the productions that NYU was doing and Juilliard was doing and Yale was doing, right, at the time, like they were doing some of Tony Kushner's first productions of Angels, wow, in America and Perestroika. I saw Michael Stuhlbarg do Angels in America at Juilliard before it was out.
Really?
And there was a lot of opportunity for actors in those programs because of our proximity to being in New York. Then you also get to see actors who you were there with as, you know, third year students go into the world. You get to see them manage their careers. So you kind of have an experience of being in the workplace and studying at the same time.
Now, but so because you're really, like, more than almost anybody I've talked to, a theater guy. I mean, you're a theater actor, really, for the most part. I mean, that's what you do. When everyone, yeah, if anyone ever says, like, what happened to Billy Crudup? It's like, he's probably doing a play, yeah, right?
Well, that's almost always the case.
But that's a choice you make.
Yeah. I don't know. You go to where you feel right, you know, where you feel. I don't have wild ambitions in terms of, like, collecting money and things, you know, and like.
You make a living.
I do. Listen, I'll tell you what. You want to know how I made a living? There are some things money can't buy. For everything else, there's MasterCard.
I've heard that.
Let me tell you, that gave me my agency to do as many plays as I wanted to for a while because it was a guaranteed sum, you know, like.
How long did you do that? Like a decade?
13 years. And so,
oh my God.
It really is, again, of the things to be embarrassed about, it was mortifying to me. But obviously I kept that ball rolling as long as I could.
That's a lifetime's worth of money. But I think it's interesting that you really, because, like, going into this interview, there was this idea that, like, all right, so you made, because I'd read that, you made the bread doing the commercial, and so you could choose what you wanted to do. But for some reason, I automatically thought, well, why isn't he in more movies then? Because you chose theater.
Well, yeah, I do. It was always my plan to do as much of everything as I could. And the fact of the matter is, I wasn't getting great parts in movies at a certain point. I was getting great parts on stage. And yeah, I went to where the great parts were because that, again, like, why would I refuse a great part? I mean, you know, the Vineyard Theater where I was nude first, where I did Harry Clark, my first thought at reading this piece was, no, Jesus, that's so much work. Why would anybody ever do that? That's exhausting. And then in the middle of the night, I wake up, how many people get the opportunity to open a one-person show in New York? Get off your fucking ass and get to the theater, you know, like that,
yeah,
is typically my response. So the kinds of things that I got to do working with Martin McDonagh, actually, Michael Stuhlbarg was in the production with Jeff Goldblum and Jelko Ivanek that we did of a play called The Pillow Man.
Right.
Doing The Coast of Utopia, which was a Tom Stoppard play that, you know, was a three-part epic about Russian philosophers at the turn of the, I don't know, 19th century or something. And it was spectacular at Lincoln Center. And you would come see it. You would see the first part on Tuesday, the second part Wednesday, the third part Thursday, or you could come see them all on Saturday. Start at 11, then these marathons, and every one of those marathons was sold out. So I was getting opportunities like that.
You won a Tony for that, right?
I did win a Tony. I should get it, bring it. I should have brought all to show you. Just I should carry it with
me. I believe you.
Just as evidence. I'm looking around like, did I get a Tony for it? But
it's over there somewhere. Yeah.
Just the experience of it.
Yeah.
To me, that's the kind of life I wanted to lead. So, you know, if I was getting those kinds of opportunities in film to work with, you know, the caliber of people that I wanted to work with, it's very likely I would have been doing more film. But, you know,
but what do you think that was about? Why don't you think that happened? I mean, it seems like you were like, I mean, it seems like you can definitely carry a movie.
Well, things come and go, you know, like, and you get opportunities, or somebody like me got a lot of opportunities early on based upon potential. And so,
oh my God. So you were you were in that movie Sleepers.
Yeah,
man. That movie's so fucking heavy, man.
Yeah.
That was your first movie.
That was the first one that came out. I did an independent film before that called Grind.
Uh-huh.
Adrian Shelley, Paul Schulze, Amanda Peet. And then I had a small part in a Woody Allen movie, called Everyone Says I Love You. But yeah, that was the first big one that came out. And then I did, Inventing the Abbots, Pat O'Connor and Joaquin Phoenix and Jennifer Connelly. And then, so I got an opportunity to be a lead in, Without Limits about the runner, Steve Prefontaine.
You were great in that.
Oh, thanks, man.
I still, when I jog, I still remember things that, you know, you were told in that movie.
That's killer. That's, that was that guy, the guy, Steve Prefontaine, he had an indelible image in my memory because my dad loved him and had the cover of Sports Illustrated that he was on our countertop when I was younger. You know, I must've been 5 or 6 or something, but this haunting image of him was with me the whole time. And so when I saw his name, it was with, you know, Robert Towne, who wrote Chinatown. It was being shot by Conrad Hall, Donald Sutherland, and produced by Tom Cruise and, Paula Wagner. And so, you know, I was punching above my weight at that point. And if you don't deliver under those circumstances, you're unlikely to get those opportunities again until you do deliver in something, you know. It's just like from a financial point of view, if they're mostly interested in, like, even Almost Famous, that didn't do well at the box office when it came out, you know.
So the Steve Prefontaine movie didn't do great.
No.
And Almost Famous didn't do great.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's some portion of it. And some portion of it is that I would say no to things because I was doing a play and people were like,
and Jesus, everyone loved Jesus as Son.
Yeah, but we couldn't get people to see it. It's like, have you seen the cast for that? It's an unbelievable. It's like a really great cast, but we couldn't get people to the theater.
Well, it's so, a heavy movie. I get it. And it was an indie movie.
It is.
Well, right?
And it's beautifully unconventional. I love that about it. But also too, you know, like, at a certain point, if you keep saying no because you're doing a play, people, they get pissed off at you, I think. And then also 16 years ago, I had a son. So I wanted to be located here in New York as much as possible. And, you know,
and that was before the commercials.
It was in the middle. I got that commercial probably in 97, 98.
But that's also like that. That was also the thing you had to deal with is, you know, the press was not too kind to you around your relationships.
You know, what is there to say about that? I mean,
I don't know.
I appreciate people using trauma for their own clickbait and fodder.
Right.
Yeah. You know, go for it. I'm just not going to participate.
Right.
So there's not a whole lot to navigate there. And who can say what the effect of that is, you know?
How is everybody now? Do you get along with her and the kid and everybody?
Listen, we all do the very best we can. But, you know, one of the reasons I don't comment, well, there's like three good reasons. First of all, there are other people involved. And unless they want to talk about it themselves, what the fuck am I going to say?
Well, that's right. You know, I've learned that the hard way. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember doing an interview early on and I talked about my childhood. And so the writer summed it up as like his traumatic childhood from, you know, like, and my mom read that as one of the first pieces and, you know, called me crying. And I was like, oh, mom, shit, we got to get, you know, like some understanding of this.
How
you know,
gonna...
you know, it's not, otherwise this is going to be a tough ride.
Well, see that, but that's interesting because now when you talk about it, the tone is different and the trauma is less. It doesn't come off as traumatic because you've put things into perspective.
Well, and when you're older, I guess that happens.
And you're successful.
Well, that's that. One of the things that in addition to being protective of the people in my life that don't have a voice when I decide to do an interview, I was really protective early on of having any kind of public persona because my whole jam was going to try to be a character actor. So
right.
if you know shit about me, I'm not going to be able to be two different things in two different movies and have you think it. You should never, you should like at the end of the movie go, oh, that was Billy Crudup. I didn't know that. Oh shit.
Right.
You know, that was going to be my whole, I just wasn't like great at it at the beginning. You know, I was giving like some kind of like, good-ish performances, but they were in lots of different kinds of things. So what the industry wants you to do is cultivate a personality at that point and become a star so that they can use you, you know, for their own nefarious
purposes. But it's interesting because, you know, I think at that time, you're probably a little too attractive to be a regular character actor.
Yeah, I had too much work done too early, and that was a fault of mine. I thought it was going to be great for us. And these cheekbones are this is cartilage from my head.
You know what I'm saying?
And I can't. You're no, not, trust me. It was.
You're no. Every headline. You're no Ned Beatty.
That brings up so many different memories. Oh my God, I love Ned Beatty. Holy shit! Oh no, I wish I wasn't Ned Beatty. I am the Ned Beatty. But no, I was. I had, you know, a very photographable, is that the word? Photographable
photographic.
Face. Photographic. That's the one we're looking for, Mark.
Yeah.
And so people, I was really aware early on of how people wanted to cast me. And I would look at some of these parts and say, I don't know how to play that guy. Like, you need somebody who can do a hero. And that I need a different angle. Like, I need.
Really?
Yeah, that those are the things that appeal to me. They're interesting to me.
But that's the reason you would actually turn down leads because this guy comes out on top. He's like a star.
You know what? Here's the thing with heroes, mostly when they're written in subpar material, is they don't have any character traits, so people can project shit onto them.
Right.
They don't have any inner monologue. They don't.
Okay.
What they have is the fierceness of their action. And the ability to muscle through the obstacles with grit, grace, and a little bit of sexiness. I didn't have that character in me. You know, like I had different characters in me. That was a
come on, you just didn't want to pretend. They're just paying you to pretend, Billy.
You got to go to where you're good at it. I could play Steve Prefontaine because he was fucked up and he was kind of a dick at times. You know, that's
flawed.
An interesting,
yeah.
He was
yeah.
a thorn in the side of the machine, you know, like, so he was a bit of an anti-hero, and it's the same with Russell in Almost Famous. He's an anti-hero, you know, he makes some fucked up decisions. You never know what his angle is.
Well, that's interesting. Isn't that interesting? Is that the business, you know, theoretically the industry wanted to make you a leading guy because you look like a leading guy
right.
and you hold the screen like a leading guy, but something inside of you wasn't going to do that.
Yeah, I I can be a shitty one of those. You know, if that's what you guys are looking for, but.
And then he played a bunch of fucking like mildly shitty people.
Yeah. Well, and those were the ones that I was more interested in, you know, like
right.
the characters in Spotlight, this guy in the morning show. And yeah, so many of the plays that I've done are the ones who are wrestling with internal as well as external conflict.
But I like the guy in. You were just a journalist in that Jackie movie, but Spotlight,
oh, yeah.
you were the lawyer, right?
I was the lawyer, exactly.
Right. Who, yeah. And yeah, right. Right. So
that's
that guy,
a really fascinating story too. That guy, cause
I love that movie.
Yeah. And that was a great movie. And Tom McCarthy, when I read it on the page, I was like, no, he just seems like a dick. I don't quite understand him. And he goes, let me tell you the story of this guy. And it turns out that, he had been negotiating all of these deals between the victims and the church. In no small part because he was abused as a child, and he knew that all of the systems were going to be obstacles in the way of them getting anything. So he was like set upon himself, listen, I'm going to get you 20 grand and a sit down with the bishop, and that's the best you're going to do anywhere. And Tom was like, so I'm not going to write that in any of it, but that's what's going to be going through you. So that makes him an interesting presence on the screen because there's this whole mysterious inner monologue going on. And in fact, he actually had sent the paper names of these people before, and the paper buried it. And they put that in the movie after they discovered it during interviewing him, where he was like, wow. I hope you're not going to make me the villain in this. Let me tell you, you know, the effort right. that I made.
So that's interesting, because, like, you know, you think, like, it's kind of bizarre. Like, what effect do you think, like, because you've done pretty well for yourself. It just worked out that way. But there's nothing, I don't know. Like, do you think that your father's disposition and his mode of operating has made you more sort of attracted to these type of characters?
I suspect there's a whole lot of different influences. And back to my earlier point, I wanted to go for the most disparate kinds of interesting parts so I could build up as much facility so I could last for a long time. So it's actually anti my dad. What I wanted to do was work consistently. And the way to do that, as I was taught in school, is build an arsenal. So you can deliver a lot of different things. And I didn't want to be pigeonholed, because I knew that was, I would have no arsenal. Once I got older and the cheekbones started to droop, I was going to be dead in the water. So
it was anti your dad because you wanted to have some security in a business.
Exactly.
That was,
stability, it was, predictability.
Right.
Which that comes was, from, exactly. Which comes from being able to adapt to.
But it's interesting, though, isn't it, that the characters that you want to play are not murderers. They're just sort of slightly morally dubious.
Yeah.
And working.
I would say that is interesting.
See, look at that. You're just trying to get close to him after all these years. That's all.
I can understand that. Yep. You tend to miss them when they're gone.
Yeah. But like, I like the character, the Corey Ellison character is a surprising character, really, because, like, you know, it's a great character. You do a great job with it. And I think, because you don't want to like him just because of what you project onto him. And then as the show goes on and you realize that, you know, he has a certain integrity to him somehow.
Right.
Because of his own sort of problems, which he reveals, I think it makes it a very unique take on that guy.
I do too. When I read that, I had to call. I mean, I had an immediate response that was something like, what the fuck is going on with this person? How does somebody imagine that that's an okay way to be in life? You know, so my curiosity was piqued about what was happening underneath him. And that's always a great place to start creatively, where you got a lot more questions than answers. And so I know when I'm reading a script and I pause to like think about it, and I can kind of visualize like moving around, or I'm kind of daydreaming about this person and trying to see if there's any kind of authentic version of me that's in there that I can, I know that like that's a character I should go towards, because typically those are the ones where we become most creatively engaged, and right. and it's rewarding, you know. And so this was one where I was like, man, I've seen this fucking New York angler my whole life, and this guy who is just a room reader, who you can't put your finger on what his motivations are other than the display of his incredible social calculus. You know, like that's what he's capable of doing, managing chaos in real time. And there are people in New York like that. I mean, everywhere, you know, they're the people who will sell you sunscreen when you're getting out of the train when on a sunny day. And then the next day they'll be there with umbrellas, you know, they're just.
But this guy's got like, you know, once he's trying to, you know, sort of connect with Reese's character, you know, he's offering up a vulnerability that seems genuine, even amongst the hustle, you know, even within the hustle.
Well, I think it's a question, because, you know, some of the greatest hustlers can project a kind of authenticity because, again, they're reading people and they know Corey knew in that moment what she needed to feel safe in this transaction. And he had enough empathy for her as a woman trying to establish herself and her moral agency in this environment that he could identify with her.
Isn't that weird, though? Like the hustle, like the idea of empathy in that type of character, even when you look at this fucking current president, that is it empathy or is it just a
a mode of manipulation. I mean, I guess the empathy is there at the core, but ultimately its goal is not to empathize.
I think that's a great question. And that was a source of ongoing conversation with Carrie. And I think we discovered a kind of moral ethic that, you know, maybe his own creation, but that really is about a more level playing field. And perversely, the reason it may be about a moral level playing field is because he just wants to display his talent with as many people as possible. So he doesn't want to shut anybody out just for no good reason, just because they're a woman or just because they're not like him. He wants the best people playing the game so he can show off how good he is in a way, you know, like, and by the way, that there, this is what some people argue is a meritocracy, you know, that get everybody in the mix, you know, that competition will promote the kind of creative productivity that will make us all thrive.
Well, I mean, but that's what you were talking about at the beginning of what one of the things that you like being part of is the ensemble driven catharsis of a story. And now it's like getting kind of meta, isn't it?
Well, so you think about then. Yeah, exactly. Like then think. So put that philosophy in the body of a guy who's like a stone cold killer and like a wackadoo. And you've got a really interesting individual with a lot of power and a capacity to evolve and shift before your eyes. That's fun to watch.
Yeah, I thought I really was, you know, amazed by the unfolding of it. I like the show, you know, and my, you know, the woman I was seeing who's not with us anymore, you know, she directed.
I know. Let me tell you. Lynn. Yeah. I wanted to pass along my condolences. I had a very superficial interaction with her, but actually after working on the morning show, she and I were talking about doing another show together that she was working on about a chiropractor called Posture that was being produced by Steve Golan, who ended up passing away too. He passed away last year.
Really?
Yeah, it's just been heartbreak after heartbreak. But I had a lot of affection for her, even in our most superficial interaction.
Yeah, she was great. But I, you know, watching the show, I was surprised at how those, you know, the whole issue of sexual impropriety and rape and what I was kind of amazed at how it was all handled. I mean, it was really written beautifully, the whole thing.
Carrie Erin, and she's responsible for, to me, the creative application of a really complicated narrative, which is we're all people. You can understand some motivations and you can't understand other motivations. And the complexity of trying to manage a moment of redistribution of power and justice for people who have been victimized is not going to be easy. And you're not going to get off by just villainizing everybody. You're going to need to understand the systems that create people, what goes into the kinds of things, and to offer that in a drama like this. I mean, they've got some incredible, to me, like tenacity and courage between the producers and Carrie. But Carrie is the one for me that I saw, you know, her and her writing team being able to put, it's one thing to think of that, but it's another thing to put it into action. That's some really sophisticated writing.
It was hard stuff. It's hard stuff to continue to understand these characters and fight your own, you know, desire or lack of desire to empathize with them.
Absolutely.
But like working with Reese, I mean, she seems like a real fucking pro. She's
a pro of pros. I would do my scenes where I was chatting away, doing my weird character and stuff. Yeah. And then I was ready for a fucking nap. I was exhausted. I was sweaty. I needed to change my clothes. And Reese, badass, is going in and watching dailies from the last one, reading scripts of stuff that are coming up, probably producing three other things on the side. And then coming back after lunch to manage the, you know, next coverage. So she and Jen are doing something I couldn't do.
Fun to work with them, though.
Fantastic. Because not only did they give me this opportunity, they encouraged as you can see, I like to talk about acting and stuff and characters and shit, and not everybody likes to hear about it.
Yeah.
Most people don't, but they encouraged that in me. They wanted me to have some insight, understanding, and agency. And that was incredibly generous from a personal point of view, but from like a, you know, cultural point of view, what they're trying to do with this show, I thought, win, lose, or draw, this is an effort I can be a part of, hold my head up high, you know?
Sure. Yeah, and the guy's a bona fide weirdo. Which
yeah, bona fide weirdo, and I definitely relate to that. And they didn't, here's the other thing too, is they didn't bat an eye at that. They loved it. And that's not an easy decision to make. You know, you want to try to again, like, it's fine if he's complicated, but can he really be a weirdo? Like, and how far can I go with that weirdness?
And also, like, like sexually ambiguous in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yes, yes. Yeah, and maybe predatorial. You can't tell. I mean, there's so many. And every time I would try, because I would see it in the script, and I often have this reaction. I'll see something that I think it's very clear. This is obviously what the story is going for. And yeah. Then we do the first table read and people will be like, you really want to play him like that? And
right.
I'm like, oh no, I don't. I was trying to do the job. Sorry. What was I supposed to be doing? My bad. I come at things from angles. I apologize. But and this was one where the first table read, they were like, I don't know who that weirdo is, but let's keep rolling with that. Like, yeah. You know, and I was kind of like ashamed inside because I was thinking, I was just trying to do what you wrote.
Right.
Because
right.
To me, it was so vivid. You know, like I wasn't trying to invent something like off the page, like
right,
in,
right.
Riffing with my improvisation. I was word perfect, you know?
Yeah. That was your interpretation of it. That's how you understood him.
That's how I understood because how I did know one, there's three people that influenced the character. And one of them, it certainly had one of the bigger brains of any of my friends that I've encountered. And when he starts to talk, when he goes into a tangent that involves some new insight that he's arrived at, he giggles to himself just at like the, isn't my brain wild the way that it works?
The discovery of it.
The discovery of it is delightful to him, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that would be a really disarming and interesting way for Corey to talk about his ideas. Not dictatorial, but right. Isn't this crazy that the world is falling apart and that it's given us this opportunity now to totally reshape things? You know, like that to
right.
me was a really interesting component to add to it. And so I was laughing from the beginning. And to me, at that point, it had seemed obvious, but I had to back up and then tell them why after a while, because they were like, why does he laugh so much?
Yeah. And they liked it.
Loved it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That,
as long as you had, there was like a quiz. They wanted you to have an answer. If you didn't have an answer.
No question about it. Yeah. If you're going to be taking swings like that, you better have an answer.
And it's exciting that you got the nomination. That's exciting.
Yeah. That was wild.
Yeah. Well, what's happening? I mean, it's so fucked up because, you know, everything's on hold and we don't know when we're going to get the next season of anything.
Yeah.
You guys hear anything?
We were 2 weeks into working when they shut us down and it's like everybody else. Yeah. We're going to start working again in June. Okay. Well, it's August. Did we do it? Because
no.
I don't remember shooting it.
They got to get the fucking tests that we can do in the morning and know in an hour.
Yeah, I think that's hasn't that just been proved by the FDA, the saliva test that the MBA and Yale put together? I think that's one of those that you can, it's pretty cheap and you can do a lot of them.
Oh, so, really? Is it working?
Well, it's been approved, and whether or not they can, you know, apply it, I don't know what kind of resources they have or what kind of infrastructure is in place to manufacture them, because it's going to be a lot of tests. But I have a feeling.
I think Apple's got the bread to put into getting a testing for
they do
together.
They've got to have a community though that is going to comply because the virus doesn't give a shit. So if our community if it continues to circulate in the community, I don't care how strong your fortress is, it's shown a lot of evidence that it's going to get in there.
Yeah, fucking
half a country full of morons.
I mean, yeah, just it, you know, living in New York and being going through this here in New York, and obviously, the first thing you want to do is try to understand it so you can protect the people around you. You know, explain it to my son and tell him why our strategy is this and why we're doing certain things, and navigate it it collectively with his mom, and you know, all of that stuff. So I was watching that shit all the time, trying to understand and getting as many updates. And the best that I can tell is that the simple stuff that people are telling you works enough. Like, change your behavior a little bit.
Wash your hands, you pig.
Wash your hands. And by the way, I was germ forward before this. I was like, you know, let them lick the sidewalk. It'll build up your immunity and stuff.
Right, right.
Like, that's good for the stuff that we knew about before. This one is new. That's what novel means. It's new. So we don't know how to deal with this one. So it's happening. We're managing this in real time. And, you know, masks being politicized and people like feeling infringed upon, it's just something I can't relate to because I've been in New York and I saw what was happening in our community before people started doing this shit, and I've seen what's happened with the numbers since then. And I've seen the protests. I've seen people gather. I've seen people at restaurants. And the fact that the numbers haven't continued to spike here gives me some reasonable, I think, understanding that this shit works. Like, it's not, we haven't cured anything, but we're able to do more because it's not circulating everywhere. And if you keep it from circulating everywhere, you can kind of do some stuff. But not everybody is in on that game.
Yeah, believe me, I'm in Los Angeles. It's a fucking clusterfuck. It's like no one's gonna take my summer away from me. It's like literally,
gonna take
that
your future. You're gonna take your future away from me.
Yeah,
I don't want to be in my apartment anymore. I mean, you know, like. And I don't have to be now in the same way. It really
it's bouncing back a little over there.
Shit, man.
Yeah, no, we'll see what happens. I mean, it's something, you know, you want to. I look, man, it's getting a little crazy, and you know, maybe we'll get through it.
I couldn't agree more with that sentiment, and the way you expressed it is exactly how it feels in me on my best days. Well, it is literally like my best days. In fact, I thought about calling you earlier today because I couldn't sleep last night. I couldn't sleep the night before. There's so many different things going on to say. Listen, I've heard your show and you're insightful. You like to talk. You're articulate. I want to be there with you. And I didn't sleep much last night because this is a crazy fucking time. Can we reschedule this? But then I was like, you can't do that to him, man. That's you might as well just go in there and ramble.
And look how lucid and rambly you were with no sleep. It's great. We got it all covered.
Oh, God, please cut it together. Like one of my.
No, it's great. Dude.
Like they do with my performances.
It was fun talking to you, man. I'm glad you did it.
Hey, great talking to you.
I'll see you around. Maybe we can hang out when we get through this shit.
I would love that.
Okay, buddy.
I love your show, man. Keep it going.
Great talk. We were moving. Had a good clip to it. Good clip to it. Once again, Billy is nominated for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Drama Series at the Emmys this year. You can watch all of season one of The Morning Show on Apple TV Plus. I have no music for you. Just sort of take a deep breath in, breathe out. In through your nose, feel the universal hum. Can you feel it? Happy birthday, Lynn Shelton. I miss you. Boomer lives! So does Monkey and LaFonda and all the cat angels everywhere. Oh, no.